Recently, I came across Billy Collins' whimsical poem, See No Evil. You know, the three monkeys who, with paws strategically placed, see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil. Collins wrote, "No one expected all three of them to sit there on their tree stumps forever, their senses covered with their sinuous paws so as to shut out the vile, nefarious world. As it happened, it was the one on the left who was the first to desert his post, uncupping his ears and then loping off into the orbits of rumors and lies, but also into the realm of symphonies, the sound of water tumbling over rocks and wind stirring the leafy domes of trees. Then the monkey on the right lowered his hands from his wide mouth and slipped away in search of someone to talk to, some news he could spread, maybe something to curse or shout about. And that left the monkey in the middle, alone with his silent vigil, shielding his eyes from depravity's spectacle, blind to the man whipping his horse, the woman shaking her baby in the air, but also unable to see the russet sun on a rough shelf of rock and apples in the grass at the base of a tree. Sometimes he wonders about the other two, listens for the faint sounds of their breathing up there on the mantle alongside the clock and the candlesticks. And some nights in the quiet house, he wishes he could break the silence with a question. But he knows the one on his right would not be able to hear, and the one on his left, according to their sacred oath, the one they all took with one paw raised, is forbidden forever to speak, even in reply. No one expected all three of them to sit there forever," Collins wrote, to which my pastor friend Carla Pratt Keyes quipped, "No one, I guess, except that middle monkey." Resolved as he was, or resigned as he was, to the oath they had taken long before. She said, "I wonder what prompted them to take it. Did the monkey raise their paws in disgust at the scandals they'd witnessed? Or the things, there were things too unpleasant to see? Did they cower and cover their senses in fear that some evil might cause them to stumble? Perhaps they acted in despair at the problem of evil all around them, the futility of engaging a world so riddled with wrong. I can see," she said, I can see why the oath they took might have seemed like a good idea." Well, given the news in recent months, I suspect we can all see. It's been quite a summer, really. I offer just a few names of people and places without comment, and your minds will fill in the details. Robert Mueller, the Squad, Greenville, North Carolina, Baltimore, the Gilroy Garlic Festival, El Paso, Dayton, Morton, Mississippi, Midland and Odessa. And we've witnessed it all. We've witnessed the unconcealed bigotry and the shameless lies. We've witnessed the vitriol in Washington and at campaign rallies, and as always, the shootings. Western civilization has taken some direct hits in the old USA this summer. Tragedies and turmoils sometimes bring out the best in people, but they can also bring out the worst. And we've seen both in unadorned fashion this summer. We've seen those who put their own lives and safety at risk in order to help others in their misery and their grief. And we've seen those who disdained any notion of a common good and sought only their own crude personal advantage. As the summer wore on and I began to sit with the text from Romans that Mark read for us this morning, I I found Paul's words taking on a greater urgency than before. Owe no one anything except to love one another. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. The commandments are summed up in this word: love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. And therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. In the 1930s, during the emergence of Hitler's Third Reich, the Swiss theologian Karl Barth wrote about that text and argued that even in the world of shadows, love must come into prominence and be undertaken as a protest against the course of the world. Barth was not talking about a Hallmark card kind of sentimental love or a weak-kneed emotion or affection, but love as a force for good, as the very power of God's grace, as the source of our full and true humanity. Love breaks down walls. Love forgives widely and even recklessly. Love binds up the broken and the brokenhearted. Love reaches across lines of division and separation. And by such love, we bless and do not harm our neighbors in this world. Indeed, said Barth, love is the breath we breathe when in the realm of evil we have no breath left. The summer has left many of us breathless, but we also saw the strength of love in hands reaching out to help, hands from across this country and from around our world. We saw it in the gracious hospitality afforded to strangers and refugees, which is, after all, the heart of Christian hospitality. We saw people raising their voices in protest of family separations at the southern border. We saw a Presbyterian camp and conference center, Moe Ranch Assembly down in Texas, go to the border to provide camp experiences for migrant and refugee children. We heard church leaders call out hate speech for what it was and press the gospel claim in behalf of the sacredness of every single human being. What we witnessed was not sentimentality, but love in action. And those paying attention could be inspired by, that is, could breathe in such a spirit of grace and hospitality and courage and love. Love is the breath we breathe when in the realm of evil we have no breath left. Breathless we are, but we've seen the strength of love and the generosity of people, the kindness of people, young and old, of all economic backgrounds, again from across our country, pushing back against hatefulness and the unconscionable silences that have accompanied it. We've seen people's hearts and courage on display. Love is the breath we breathe when in the realm of evil we have no breath left. When in the realm of evil, Barth said. What evil have we seen? Well, some of it has been clearly visible. The lies, the rage, the greed, the anger, the bigotry. And it's not been a pretty sight. But beyond such obvious evils that we saw in our television newscasts all summer, there's another evil we may have to look more carefully to see. And we won't see it so much on our televisions as in our own mirrors. The aftermath of this summer is begging us to take a long, critical look at ourselves as a people, as our cities and our societies, to look at ourselves. I've spent this summer fighting off some fear that death has visited more than the sites of the mass shootings, that perhaps our country has been dying a bit as well. It's dying not so much from threats from without, although the democratic processes are in peril because of such efforts. It's dying also of a form of heart disease, I think. We have plenty of sympathy and compassion for individuals in crisis. Our, Our hearts are healthy in that way. But we have shrugged our shoulders too often as policymakers have ignored large segments of our nation's people while magnifying the advantages enjoyed by others. Our economy has been booming, except in all those places where it has not. Our neighborhoods are thriving, except for those who are quietly being forced out. Our lack of coherent immigration policy has become an excuse for closing borders to legitimate asylum seekers. Some are reaping great rewards from private detention centers and prisons, but at what cost to our basic humanity and decency? A nation cannot sustain such failures of heart for long. One spring day in the church I served back in North Carolina, an adult class was discussing Tim Tyson's book, Blood Doesn't Sign My Name. It's a story of the murder in 1970 of a young African-American teenager by a white shopkeeper in a town roughly 30 miles northeast of ours. We spent a good bit of time on the details of the story when someone in the class changed the focus. She asked, if we were blind to so many of the injustices that led to that struggle for civil rights in this country, what injustices are we not addressing today? And much to my surprise, the consensus response was swift, and it wasn't new. It was as old as the biblical prophets and as fresh as this summer in America, because person after person named the injustice of poverty and discrimination in a nation of unprecedented abundance. To people of faith, such injustice is evil. It is insidious, and if we are not careful and not thoughtful, it will be the death of us as a society. There is, of course, an answer to this evil, and it is an answer as old as the words of the prophets itself and of the teachings of Jesus. It's an answer that is strong, not weak. An answer that is brave, not cowardly. And its name is love. Love embraces all humanity. Love for the stranger. Love that stirs in us hearts of compassion and consciences of justice. Love that stands firm in the face of evil and seeks to turn its tide, and will not rest until it does. As he looked at the rise of Hitler's madness, Karl Barth said, even in the world of shadows, love must come once again into prominence and be undertaken as a protest against the course of the world. Such love is, says Paul, the sum of all the commandments. It is our answer to lawlessness. It is the remedy for the heart disease that afflicts our nation. And it is the command of Jesus, if we take Jesus seriously, sealed for us in the new covenant we will celebrate presently around this table. We have no higher calling in our time than the bold embodiment of that kind of love. So take Christ's love with you today into this world. Take it in whatever ways you can into the streets of New York and into the halls of power. It's the most important word we have to share, the most important gift we have to offer the world. It's the most important witness we have to bear. Love is, in fact, the very breath we breathe when, in the realm of evil, we have no breath left.